Okay, let's start off with our motivation. And it becomes quite obvious when we're here in retreat how rattled people are in the world, running here, running there, doing this, doing that. And we can even feel that energy in our body sometimes. I have to do this. There's so much to do. Gotta do that. And we get quite hooked on that. On one hand, it makes us feel alive because there's this vibrating energy in our body and mind. Even though it's not particularly pleasant. But our minds are so limited at that time because the real thing that we need to pay attention to is getting out of samsara and helping other living beings get out as well. But so often we don't have the big picture in our lives. Our vision is quite narrow, quite small. So a good chunk of our practice is really about habituating ourselves with a bigger vision of life, a bigger vision of our present experience, how it fits into the universe, and a bigger vision of what our potential is. And of course, a bigger vision about how things actually exist. So it takes a lot of study to have these things pointed out to us. And we need to think about it, make sure we understand it well and that it makes sense. And then we need to familiarize ourselves with it again and again and again, so that there's some real deep transformation in how we look at the world, at ourselves, at life in general. And one part of that transformation is seeing that there's a lot of other living beings around. Countless beings. They all want happiness and they don't want suffering. And by far the greatest majority have no idea what the cause of happiness is and what the causes of suffering is. Or actually they have inverted ideas of what causes happiness and suffering. Just like we do. When our mind's not a Dharma mind. So while we have this opportunity to understand the Dharma and apply it, let's put energy into doing that. Because it's a very short time we have, and there's a lot of sentient beings there who can use our help. But in order to help, it can't be the blind leading the blind. It has to be the wise. So we have to become the wise ones first. So with compassion for all these beings, let that be our motivation for trying to become wise. And then to use our wisdom to benefit all beings. Okay, so I got word there were a few questions from the go-around last week. Yesterday. Have you noticed that your sense of time in retreat becomes very strange? Yeah.
It was last month.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the first one that we have here is somebody who did a 3-month Vajrasattva retreat before and had a very nice relationship with Vajrasattva where they had lots of conversations And, you know, they were doing a lot of purification with, as it's put here, yucky stuff flowing out of the body. Yucky is actually coming in all the questions. I don't know. Is that the latest word that everybody's using is yucky? It rhymes with ducky. Maybe that's why you're using it. Okay. But with Amitabha, there appears to be no relationship. Talking to him doesn't work. He just sits there and stares at her. What to do? Well, you know, there's some people who are talkative and some people who are quiet. So maybe it's the same with Buddhas. And maybe you're just being quiet and not so talkative. And maybe the fact that Amitabha isn't talking to you means that it's time for you to be quiet and look inside. Yeah? Anyway, relax. Just do the practice. Don't worry about it. Okay. Then somebody else is saying that they're used to doing sadhanas where you purify yourself with light and then send the light outward. And, in this Amitabha sadhana, there doesn't appear to be that. Actually, it's there. I mean, one way to involve other sentient, because the question is how can we include other sentient beings and benefiting them in the sadhana? One way is you put Amitabha on the crowns of all the living beings around you. You imagine yourself surrounded by all living beings in human form, okay? And it doesn't mean they all have to be human beings this life, but you imagine them in human form. Put Amitabha on top of their heads, and as you're saying the mantra, the light flows into them and purifies them and brings them the realizations of the path as well. Or another way to do it is at the end of the sadhana, when Amitabha dissolves into your heart, then have a small Amitabha, visualize a small Amitabha there, but without putting a lot of attention at your heart center. But just imagine that and then radiate light out from the Amitabha at your heart that touches all the living beings. And imagine sending out emanations, you know, of whatever the different living beings need. Yeah, so whoever needs washing machines, you send that out. And yeah, you don't send out AR-15s, sorry. Nobody needs those, okay? But you just think about what other sentient beings in the six realms possibly need, and then from the Amitabha at your heart, you send that out to them. Okay, so you can put that in quite easily. And then the third person said that when she does the visualization with the light, she experiences some physical shocks when the light comes in. Not at all painful, but strange experience. She physically jumps or twitches in response to it. Yeah. So what? Just relax. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Don't make a big deal out of these kinds of things. Yeah. I mean, we can have all sorts of unusual experiences in our meditation, and we can get really fixated on them. And that all becomes actually a big distraction. Yeah. So just do your practice, generate renunciation and bodhicitta and the correct view, and relax about everything else. Yeah? Okay. Any other questions?
This is just something to help think about. Every time in the aspiration prayer, when it says, may I be able to complete all the practices of the six far-reaching practices, my mind says, there are no difficult sentient beings in this environment. How am I going to develop fortitude any further than I already have it.
What are you talking about? What an idiot you are. You say there's no disagreeable sentient beings in this environment.
There are in this environment, no problem.
Come on, I'm sure there's some of us. I mean, we can attack her, can't we?
No problem with this particular environment.
I can't believe it.
But in the pure realm, there are not.
Yes.
So that's really what I'm puzzled with, how to think about that.
Okay.
Because if we need sentient beings to be generous too, I mean, we need them.
Yes.
A bodhisattva needs them.
Yes.
But here we are in a place where everybody's great.
Yeah, that's your pure view.
Okay.
Ask somebody else here. Is everybody great? You know, I have some things to complain about. You want me to hear my complaints? They're really important. So what you're basically saying is, if you get reborn in the Pure Land, how do you cultivate fortitude? Even how do you cultivate generosity? Because, you know, the food comes off the trees and everything's there. Yeah. So I think again, you would use your imagination doing that. And then in the Pure Land, remember, when you get to a certain level, then you make emanations and go out to the realms where, you know, there's sentient beings who are really in need. Yeah. But the idea is that you go there with a mind that is much more capable of helping them. Okay. I don't know. I'm sure we can get a few disagreeable ones in the Pure Land. Don't you think?
Maybe they do appear here.
Yeah. No, when you're stuck in a lotus, you know, you're going to be hammering to get out. Why don't they let me out? Who's the caretaker of these lotuses anyway? Okay. I hope people realized I was, teasing her there. Sometimes people don't realize when I tease people and when I'm sarcastic, and they get very horrified. Yes?
When you're reborn in a Pure Land, is it a new incarnation, or are you still you?
It's like in any rebirth. You shed your old aggregates and you take new aggregates.
Including a new form, a new...
Yeah. Yeah, this body doesn't go to the Pure Land. Yeah, this body is a polluted body. Yeah, I mean, it gets old and sick and dies, and then we want to take it with us. No. Yeah, it's completely, it gets recycled here.
Do you have a name?
Pardon?
Do you have a name?
I imagine so. Yeah. Different bodhisattvas there have different names. Yeah. But I kind of like that thing, and, you know, She Carries Me, where it says, I have no name, I have no home. There's something, I think, quite freeing about that. But I imagine on a conventional level, they have to say, you know, that bodhisattva over there, yeah, named so-and-so, yeah, who arrived late for teachings. Something like that, yeah.
Two questions. When you've got the light from Amitabha flowing through you, is it like, sometimes... then I can imagine that then I kind of send out light from me, Amitabha's from me to sentient beings then. Mm-hmm. Is that appropriate at that point?
You mean you as an ordinary person are sending out Amitabha's?
Kind of like he purifies me so that I could become a light body. Then it's kind of like I'm not really there anymore. I'm just the Amitabha's light, and then that light goes out.
I think it's better to stick with the two visualizations I spoke about.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is... chanting the mantra the same as chanting Amitabha's name? Because in a lot of the Chinese traditions, it mentions chanting his name a lot. Is it the same as chanting his mantra?
Yeah. I think, you know, when it talks about that, that because, you know, Om Amitabha Sri is his name, and it's like Amidofo. So, you know, in one tradition you do Namo Amitofo or just Amitofo, and the other one you would do Om Amitabha Sri or Om Amitabha Sri Soha. Yeah. So, like I said, with, you know, different experiences, you know, if you had a good experience with Vajrasattva, then you say, oh, nothing's happening this retreat. You know, that's okay. Yeah, because sometimes what happens is if we have an experience in meditation, then we want to recreate it. We get attached to it. We want to recreate it. As soon as we want to recreate an experience, it doesn't work well. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just you rejoice that you had it and you leave it and you get on. Yeah. I think this is what they mean when they talk in Zen about beginner's mind. So you approach a new situation freshly without a mind that wants something from it. Oh, I want, you know, these same experiences that I had in the other meditation, or I don't want such and such to happen, or I like and I don't like, just to kind of, as much as possible, shed that and just do the practice. Yeah, and then, you know, because there's so much that's just this judgmental, discriminating mind, of, you know, am I doing it right? You know, I'm sure everybody else here is like, Amitabha's appearing to them in their dreams, and I'm just having nightmares. And, you know, and this whole thing, we compare ourselves to everybody else. And, you know, I've been in retreat for 2 weeks. I should be, you know, have some realization of emptiness by now. You know, these are the kinds of things that we just have to let go of. Yeah.
I try to look at each meditation session as kind of a partnership with Amitabha. So I let him do his thing. Like, you know, I have the image of him, but I say, well, what can you share? What do you want to share with me? What can you teach me? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he takes kind of different forms. He gets bigger, he gets smaller. Well, maybe that's not good, but that way it keeps it interesting, and I'm able to approach each experience mm-hmm. with the open mind that you talk about. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, otherwise I can find it kind of stiff and, you know, repetitive if it's just like a cutout of his shape in the same exact form each time.
Mm-hmm. So what are you saying in the break time, that you're seeing every experience you have as kind of Amitabha teaching you something?
No, during the visualization.
Oh.
It's kind of
he's changing forms and
well, he maintains his, you know, human appearance and his color. Uh-huh. But he kind of gets bigger, smaller, and yeah. So I'm not using it so much as a concentration meditation.
Yeah.
I'm sort of, I wanted to develop my creative, because I want to visualize better, and I realize I need to develop my creativity.
Yeah.
And it's easier for me to do that if I let go and sort of say, Amitabha, how do you want to show yourself to me right now? Uh-huh. I just enjoy it.
So. Yeah. I don't know, when people have asked my teachers about, you know, can we change the shape of the deity and the form of the deity and things like that, they've all said better stick with you know, how they've appeared, because they have some kind of, that has some kind of symbolism and meaning. That's all I can say.
Just wanted to say it was really, really helpful to hear all of the nuns talking about their experiences and just learning how long it takes, how much effort and perseverance, and I'm very thankful for all the sharing, everybody's sharing.
Yeah, I think that's quite, quite helpful, because otherwise really we have so many expectations and wrong ideas. Yeah. I was, one time many years ago, I was in Australia, and a Theravada group asked me to come and give a talk. And I gave this talk, and this brand new nun, she had not been ordained for very long. It, you know, it was Q&A time. She said, "Tell us about your realizations." And I said, "I don't have any." And the monk that had organized the talk said, "Oh, she just wants, you know, tell her, she wants to know what you have to look forward to, you know?" And I said, hard work. Yeah, that becomes joyful effort, you know? That becomes an inner connection with the Dharma and transforms your mind. But I have no realizations. This poor girl, like, "Oh, you've been ordained that long and you don't have any realizations? What have I gotten myself into?" Yeah. But you see, you know, if you just accept this kind of stuff, then your life is so much smoother. Yeah. Whereas when we're always, you know, whether it's in our regular life or our Dharma life, grasping at some goal, "I've got to achieve this, I've got to be that, I've got to have that," then that whole attitude, I mean, first of all, it just makes us incredibly anxious, which impedes actually doing anything, you know, that is, you know, helpful. Now, you can still do a few things that are helpful when you're anxious, but it really, you know, impedes your own happiness and joy in life and, you know, your creativity, whatever it is, you know, when we create all these conceptions about stuff. Yeah. But you see, this is what we're taught. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is what we're taught in society. And, you know, you should be this. You should have this goal. You should, yeah. Some years ago, this was even, I don't know, really long time ago, I was talking with my brother, and he's a doctor. So I was supposed to be one too, but things turned out differently. Anyway, so he said to me, this must have been 1989, he said to me, "What's your goal for 5 years from now? What do you want to be? What do you want to be doing?" And I said, "I want to be kinder." "Well, what do I mean? What do you mean? What do you want to be doing? Don't you want to have, you know, your own monastery, your own Dharma center, your own this, your own that?" I said, "I want to be kinder." You know, I mean, he had a really hard time with it. Yeah. So, and then look what I wound up with. Okay. So it's a strange thing, because you want to have the goal of full awakening. You want to have that aim. You want to have, I mean, you need direction in your life, where you're going. But it's, you know, "I'm going in that direction," but it's not, you know, grasping at it. When am I going to get there? Competing with everybody else around me to get there before they do. Yeah. To look good while I'm, you know, while I'm getting there. It's like, oh, that's pretty useless. Yeah. I used to kind of worry sometimes about, kind of, what am I doing with my life? I remember when I was 36, I was thinking, wow, look what Martin Luther King did, you know, when he was 36. Look at me, you know, it's like, he did amazing things by age 36. And there was I just, you know, kind of toddling along. I was teaching in, where was I? Just Singapore somewhere. And then I said, well, you know, all I really have to show for it is trying to follow my teacher's instructions. But I think that's good enough. Yeah? Yeah, if you have a good teacher, you try and follow your teacher's instructions. So try and do that. Yeah, but all this thing, I want to get there, I want to achieve something, I want to be somebody. They're all going to be enlightened before me. I'm going to be the last sentient being. Well, that's good. I'll have so much compassion from all these other beings. Yeah? They're all going to have compassion for me, finally. Yeah. Because I'll be the last sentient being. But, you know, when I was in this time of, you know, kind of really wondering, well, what am I doing with my life? What have I accomplished, you know? So I was living at that time in a, I'm getting way off track, but anyway, yeah, I was living at a Chinese temple, and the master there was quite wonderful. She had, it was an old folks' home as well. One part was the temple. There were just a few of us nuns. And then the rest was an old folks' home for women, lots of them. And my room was up on the third floor, and it overlooked the columbarium. If you don't know what a columbarium is, that's where they have all the vases with the ashes, you know. So I had nice awareness of death a lot, yeah. And I really admired this nun for what she did and how she took care of other beings and so on. And you know, then I left Singapore and I would come back and I always like to go and visit her. And she wound up, she built this incredible, huge Dharma building, you know, the one at on Lavender. Yeah, what's it called now? The Taipei Buddhist Center. Yeah, because it was Taipei Temple where I lived. So, and it's on the intersection of two really busy streets. There's a Buddha on the top. Huge place. She built the whole place. She used to, she really helped the groups at the Pali's and the Buddhist groups at the Pali's and the universities and so on. She just, you know, was incredibly generous helping other people. And I remember one day going to talk to her because I really appreciated her. And she was saying, you know, like, oh, I haven't done anything. You're so, you know, you've been able to study. You know so much. You're able to teach. I can't really teach. And like this kind of stuff she was saying. And yet she was smiling and she was happy. And it made me realize that, you know, we emphasize different things in different lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to be everything and do everything in one lifetime. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I realized she was completely happy with her life of, you know, with the old folks home, building this Buddhist center, helping all these other people. And that's what she specialized in this life. And she created tremendous merit doing that, you know. And I was specializing in something else this life. And then probably next life, you know, then you do something else. Each lifetime you know, put your energy in, you know, some lifetimes you focus maybe more on creating merit, others lifetimes on purification, other lifetimes on studying, other lifetimes on teaching, other lifetimes on serving society, you know. So there's all different sorts of things you do within one lifetime and also among different lifetimes. And so when you have that picture, then it becomes really rather useless and silly to compare yourself to other living beings who are on the path. Yeah, because we're all doing different things according to our karma, but we're all purifying, we're all creating merit, we're all planting seeds of the Dharma in our mind stream. And so, you know, comparing ourselves to other people, wondering if we're doing okay, are we good enough? You know, all of that really becomes something that doesn't make any sense at all. Yeah, when you think over many, many lifetimes. Yeah, so it's kind of you do what is in front of your nose and stop fighting the reality of what the situation your karma is putting you in. You know, it doesn't, I'm not saying that you just, if you're in difficult situations, when I say stop fighting the reality, I don't mean, oh, you just completely capitulate to the situation and give up. No, what I mean is like, okay, like maybe you have a lifetime with a bunch of obstacles. Okay, this is my lifetime with a bunch of obstacles. This is my Dharma practice. That's okay. You know, dealing with these obstacles is my Dharma practice, and I'll do it. And then next life, you know, you're doing something else. So, yeah. I had one friend, a Tibetan monk, really so creative. He was the one who, at the beginning, you know, when we learned about using digital stuff, who would create mandalas and like look at them from many different sides, you know. So he would make a Yamantaka mandala online and like show you the different syllables and look at it from above and below and all these kinds of stuff. And he died when he was quite young. I can't remember what he died from. It wasn't an accident. It was some kind of disease. I can't remember how old he was. I don't know, maybe 30, 35, something, quite young. But I just always think of him as being a very happy, contented person, even though he got, you know, a very grave illness at a young age, you know, and he had an incredibly fortunate life. He was a monk at Namgyal Monastery in Dharamsala. And, you know, it's like, yeah, didn't last for long, but he did what he could and he was happy with it. Yeah. I always think of him and pray for him. Yeah. I didn't know him real well, but there was some kind of connection. So we were on exercise 6.4, right? Okay. So did you, it said, create at least 10 of your own syllogisms. Yeah. And so just some of the advice, you know, he said, when you're trying to think of a reason, think categorically, not descriptively. Okay. So for instance, with the syllogism about Monet, above, you know, instead of trying to describe what an impressionist painter is, just he's an impressionist painter because he's a French impressionist. The argument, I think, is flat. It doesn't tell you anything. But his point is, you know, think of it as a noun, not as a bunch of adjectives strung together. Okay, and then go through it, and you know, I thought it was interesting when he said, like, for the property to really ask yourself, is that subject that sign? You know, is it really? And is it true that whatever is that sign is the predicate? Is that true? And is it really true that if it's not the predicate, then it's not the reason? And so, to really examine those and ask yourself, is that true? Okay. And then another advice he had was when you formulate your object, your argument, to be precise. Yeah. So don't say that a blue car is blue because you will get shot down. That's the first thing you learn in Dura, is a white horse is not white. Why not? Horse is not a color. Yeah. You can say the color of a white horse is white, but you can't say a white horse is white. Okay, so you have to be quite specific when you're making your arguments. And then I like the way he put in the little thing from Kenzo Yeshe Tupten. You know, Kenzo Yeshe Tupten once said to me, "Happy people don't drink and take drugs." Yeah, he should have told that to our generation. Well, he did. And we listened, you know? We listened. So I think but it's quite true, isn't it? You know? Happy people don't drink, don't take drugs, don't have a shopping addiction. Yeah. Don't have a golf addiction. You know, whatever it is. Okay. Of course, maybe we have to admit that we're unhappy people. Yeah, and that's why we do some of these things. So, did you make some syllogisms there? Okay, anybody want to do their syllogism and run through it like he was saying in 6.4 with asking yourself those questions? Okay?
Ethical conduct is one of the three higher trainings that is essential to attain liberation.
Mm-hmm. Because?
That's why it's confused.
Oh, say it again.
Ethical conduct is one of the three higher trainings because it is essential to attain liberation.
Okay, because it's essential to attain liberation. Okay, so go through now and evaluate that. You know, tell us the property, the pervasion, and so on.
Forward pervasion.
First you do the property.
You said the property.
Yeah. So the property is the reason applying to the subject.
Yeah. So ethical conduct is essential to attain liberation.
Yeah. So is that really true?
Yes.
Yeah, that works. Okay, good. Then do the pervasion.
Forward pervasion?
Yeah.
Essential to attain liberation is one of the three higher... Three higher trainings?
No. What's the pervasion? Somebody want to give her a hand? What's the pervasion?
An effort is essential to attain liberation is necessarily one of the three higher trainings.
Okay. So if it's essential for attaining liberation, it's necessarily one of the three higher trainings. Is that true?
Yes, because everything that's essential to liberation is contained in the three higher trainings.
No,
because tantra is not.
Isn't it essential to be born in a human life? But that's not one of the three higher trainings.
Yeah. Yes, you can say if it's essential for attaining liberation, it's one of the three higher trainings.
What about renunciation?
What, if it's renunciation, it's one, make your syllogism.
I was just giving the example, renunciation is not one of the three higher trainings, and yet it's essential for liberation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Archive attain liberation with full conduct, concentration, and wisdom.
Syllogism is about liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is isn't it sufficient for an arhat to attain liberation with the three higher trainings?
With the three higher trainings. If you say that because you have, there's a way of putting the Eightfold Noble Path into the three higher trainings, okay? So it would depend on how you, according to which tenet system you were speaking. Yeah? You know, because what your path factor of wisdom is going to vary. Okay? But then she brought up renunciation, the aspiration to attain awakening. Yeah? Is that one of the three higher trainings? Yeah? Okay, because you gain renunciation by, meditating on the first two of the four truths.
I see your point. I'm just wondering if we say in the Mahayana that all of the path is contained in the six perfections, but I guess maybe they don't say all of the path is contained in the Eightfold Noble Path.
They do. The Theravada, the Pali system says the whole, it's all contained in there. But then they would say the whole path is contained in there.
So then they must put renunciation in with right view or right...
With what?
Right view or right intention or...
Yeah, I'm not sure what they would put renunciation with in. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's still a precious human life.
They probably put it in with intention. Yeah, although usually they talk about intention being benevolence, non-cruelty, and what's the third one? I think non-harmfulness, something like that. Interesting question. Yeah, maybe we need to investigate that some more. Yeah?
So you said that it's included, it's all in the path. The path is what's essential for liberation.
Are you talking about the true path?
The true path is what's essential for liberation.
Yeah, but if it's essential for liberation, is it necessarily the true path? In other words, are there other things that are essential for liberation that are not the true path? He said, for example, attaining a precious human life. Okay, so the cause of a precious human life is ethical conduct. That's essential. But would you say attaining a precious human life is essential? Yeah?
Is it possible to practice the three higher trainings if you're not a human? Doesn't it assume that you have a human form?
No, there's some beings in the form realm that practice it. Yeah. You have the non-returners are in the form realm. Yeah, so they also practice the true path. Yeah.
So that means
okay.
It's not essential.
What isn't essential?
Precious human life.
To become a stream enterer, I think it might be. I don't know. I think so. I don't know if you can become. Because also it depends so much on the tenet system you're talking about too. Yeah. Okay, yes.
This is an example of, well, it's really, but when we really learn how to debate, then we would debate all these points and then we'd know.
Yes.
It's exciting.
Yes. Yes. So does somebody want to take this on and investigate it for next week? Okay, Christina. Good. Okay, so we need to see if it's essential for liberation. Is it necessarily one of the three higher trainings? But, you know, because essential, this is what's making us look into what is essential for liberation. Because encountering a spiritual mentor, yeah, encountering the Buddha's teachings, these things are all essential for liberation.
And if you're a solitary realizer.
In a previous life of a solitary realizer, yeah. Okay, so so it seems that there are things that are essential that are not the three higher trainings specifically.
This is really interesting because it's pointing out the pervasion, what pervades, you know, because the three higher trainings are pervaded by essential for liberation, but not the other way around.
Yeah.
So she kind of flipped her, flipped her syllogism, she might actually have something.
So you're saying if she said, flip the syllogism, what would it be?
Essential contact is one of the three higher trainings because it's essential for liberation. Oh, that's what she said. So, yeah, it flipped the other way, yeah.
Yeah. It is essential to attain liberation because it's one of the three higher trainings.
Yeah, that would work. That would work. Yeah. Ethical conduct is essential for liberation because it's one of the three higher trainings. Yeah, because there, if it's one of the three higher trainings, it is necessarily essential for liberation. Yeah. Okay, good. Somebody else's syllogism.
The self of a person is non-existent because a person is an impermanent phenomena.
Okay, the self of
a person is non-existent because a person is an impermanent phenomena.
Okay, because a person is an impermanent phenomena. Okay, so run through the three criteria.
So the subject will be the self of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the second one?
Predicate.
A predicate is the self of the person is non-existent.
Yeah, non-existent is the precedent. It's a predicate.
And then the reason?
Yeah.
Is because it's a person is an impermanent phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay, because a person is impermanent, an impermanent phenomena. Okay, so then go through.
The pervasion.
Yeah. Go tell us the three criteria.
So whatever is...
No. The
property of the subject.
Yeah. So you want to see, is the subject... the reason.
Oh.
So what's your subject?
The self of a person.
Uh-huh. And what's your reason?
A person is an impermanent phenomenon.
So does the reason apply to the subject?
It seems not.
No.
Yeah.
How about if you said, didn't use a whole statement for your reason, and you just said because it's impermanent.
Oh, I see.
Try that.
So the self of a person is impermanent.
Your whole syllogism would be a self of a person is non-existent
because it's
impermanent.
Is impermanent.
Okay. So now do your three criteria.
I don't really understand very much about the three criteria.
So the three criteria is you take the subject,
mm-hmm.
which is the self of persons.
Yes.
And you see if the reason, which is here impermanent, applies to that subject. So is the self of persons impermanent?
No.
No. So your syllogism is not going to work.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Yeah, because the reason has to apply to that subject.
But in the very beginning, say it's non-existent.
But right. Non-existent is what you're trying to prove.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So the self of person, yeah, it's true, the self of person is non-existent. But the reason isn't because it's impermanent. Because the self of persons isn't impermanent. Yeah, if something's impermanent, is it non-existent? Yeah? Try your predicate. Your privation. If something is impermanent, that's the reason,
mm-hmm.
Is it necessarily non-existent? Yeah? No. In fact, it's quite the opposite, isn't it? Yeah? If it's impermanent, it must be existent.
Oh, then in this case, should I say that because it's permanent? No.
No.
So,
no, because it can be permanent and yeah. What is the reason that the self of person is non-existent? Yeah. Yeah, because it cannot be found with ultimate analysis. Okay, so if you said the self of person is impermanent, is non-existent, because it can't be found by ultimate analysis.
Cannot be found in
ultimate analysis. Okay, so then what would the property be? What would, in the new syllogism, what would the property be? Found analysis. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Then what's the privation? If it can't be found by ultimate analysis, it is necessarily non-existent. Is that true? Yes.
Oh, conventional phenomena.
How about what?
Conventional phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah. If it can't be found by ultimate analysis, it's non-existent. That's true. Conventional phenomena can't be found. Yeah, that's true. You don't see the clock with
it.
The self of person is an inherently existent person. Okay.
So when we're doing the analysis and see yourself as you really are, the mm-hmm. analysis you're using is conventional analysis.
Right.
So
No, you're using ultimate analysis. Whenever you're investigating emptiness, that's ultimate analysis. Our syllogism here isn't ultimate analysis.
But when you're going through the self, you say, how does this self exist?
Right.
And you say, well, is it my body? Well, it can't be identical to my body. It can't be identical to my mind. It can't be identical to both.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily, that. To me, that doesn't seem like ultimate analysis. It's just saying if you just take a look on a conventional basis, those things don't stand.
No, you find, okay, well, that's why you have with the four opponent powers, your second one is, if something exists ultimately, it's got to be findable. Yeah, and the four-point analysis, right? Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So so your privation there is if it exists, it should be findable by ultimate analysis.
If it exists ultimately.
Yeah, if it exists ultimately, it should be findable by ultimate analysis. Okay.
It doesn't have ultimately.
Well, I think you need to add an inherently existent self of a person.
No, the self of a person is an inherently existent person.
The self of a person is non-existent ultimately.
No, the self of a person, when you use, he used the term incorrectly. If you read ahead, he used it incorrectly to mean the conventional person. But the self of person means an inherently existent person. So if you substituted, an inherently existent person is non-existent because it cannot be found by ultimate analysis. Okay? So then Venerable Tarpa is saying, but if it can't be found by ultimate analysis, does that necessarily mean it's non-existent? And she's right. No, you have to say an inherently existent person is, well, no, you could, it's, it is totally non-existent.
It is, and there's other things.
Hmm?
I think it's like when you compare the circles.
Yeah.
You're going to run into some problems.
Mm-hmm. Because if it isn't found by ultimate analysis,
it's not necessarily non-existent. Conventional.
No. If
ultimate analysis doesn't see right.
Doesn't. Yeah.
Conventionalities.
Mm-hmm. But but what our thing is more to say the person is empty of inherent existence because it doesn't exist. It can't be found by ultimate analysis.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the way it should be phrased. Yeah, the person is empty of inherent existence because it can't be found by ultimate analysis. That way of putting it would work. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I can't find the reference in the book right now, but I also think he advised us not to use a non-existent as the subject. And that's also part of the difficulty, because a non-existent is not going to have a characteristic.
Right. Yeah. You would usually say X and X is non-existent. Well, yeah, you've got to be able to say some things are non-existent. You know,
in the predicate, take the self, it lacks inherent existence.
Yeah.
Because it's a dependent arising.
Right.
You have a subject.
So. Yeah, you have, yeah, but yourself is something existent. But, you know, surely you can make arguments that say, you know.
Well, somebody find the reference. Venerable Lhasam, you're good
actually,
about this.
Actually, the reference was only for comparison phenomena.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was for comparing.
It says that it's not the case with syllogism.
Yeah.
You can use it.
But yeah, how would you realize a non-existent? How would you have an ascertainment of the property of the subject?
Because it can't be ascertained by a valid cognizer.
That's my point.
So
how can you have...
So if you say a self of person is non-existent because it can't be ascertained by a valid cognizer, a reliable cognizer, that would work. Think about it. Okay. The self of person is non-existent because it can't be ascertained by a valid cognizer, a reliable cognizer. So what's the property there? The self of person can't be ascertained by a reliable cognizer. Is that true? Is it true?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Then, what's your privation?
Anything that can't be ascertained by a valid cognizer is necessarily non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah. If anything that is necessarily, if it's not ascertained by a reliable cognizer, it's non-existent. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so that syllogism works. Okay.
So the other one could work with ultimate analysis?
No, to use ultimate analysis as a reason, you would have to say the self, meaning the self that exists, the person, is not inherently existent because it can't be found. No. Yeah. Yeah, it can't be found by a no, no. The person is empty of inherent existence.
Because it can't be found under.
No, because it because it can't be found by. But if it can't be found by ultimate analysis, is it necessarily empty of inherent existence? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, that works. Yeah. Yeah, but still the syllogism works.
Just to make sure I heard correctly, we said that the self of a person is non-existent?
Yes, because self of person, okay? And when we talk about self of person and self of phenomena, we're talking about the objects of negation. That's why you have the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena. Yeah, so the selflessness of persons is the emptiness of inherent existence of persons. Selfless, yeah? So that's why if the selflessness of person is the emptiness of inherent existence of the person, then the self of person must be the an inherently existent person. And that doesn't exist.
The non-existent is kind of tripping me up because isn't it conventionally existent?
Self of persons is not conventionally existent. The person is conventionally existent.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. And that's why I said if you've read ahead, he gives another syllogism in a few pages. Maybe looks like nobody's read ahead. You need to read ahead. yeah. And he misdefined self of person. And he said it's talking about the person that exists. And that's not the meaning of the term. Self of person is the inherently existent person. Because remember, self can sometimes mean person, like, you know, the self is born, the self dies. And the self can sometimes mean inherent existence, the objects of negation. So here, when you say self of person, it means the inherent existence of the person. And that doesn't exist. Yeah? Yeah.
So what type of analysis does a valid cognizer use?
There's different kinds of valid, reliable cognizers. One is a direct perceiver, you know, that with your senses. And then another one is, and then there's inferential, reliable cognizers. Yeah, which is what we're trying to come up with here, is an inference. There's yogic valid cognizers that you see with a yogic mind that's a concentrated mind.
Okay, so what I was thinking in terms of conventional and ultimate analysis.
Ultimate analysis is when you're searching to find out what something really is. Conventional analysis is just when you're talking about the characteristics of things. You're not talking about emptiness, how the deeper mode of existence. That's all conventional analysis.
I'm wondering how you would characterize these two things. Like in the Pali tradition, where they're always looking for the self in the aggregates, versus in the Madhyamaka, where you're looking for the nature of the self.
Yeah, it's a little bit different, the refutation, because in the Pali tradition, mostly... Not the predominant thing that you see, but this is not all of it, is looking to see if you can find something that is the self. And so then you run through the aggregates. Are any of the aggregates the self? And then also implied in that, is the self something different from the aggregates? Yeah. But the thing that it often they would put it as, is the body the self? Whereas we would usually say, is the self the body? But in English, doesn't matter. Is the self the body? Is the body the self? Yeah. I don't know if in English it matters. In Tibetan, those things matter, but I don't know in English. Want to try another syllogism, or should we read on? We need some work with these syllogisms, huh? Yeah? It's not so easy. First of all, I mean, one big thing we learned last week is you don't use syllogisms for giving advice. Yeah? Syllogisms are not the tool for giving advice. And this is so contrary to how we talk to other people, isn't it? Because whenever we're trying to give somebody advice, we try and use a syllogism with the word should in it. Yeah? And that just doesn't seem to work. Because what we're trying to do with syllogisms is really, you know, show something about the subject. Yeah? You're trying to prove something about the subject. You're not trying to get somebody to do something. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why, you know, the word should, as soon as you put should in it, it's like, what does should mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. You asked us to also to the other day to write out things that have been troubling you this week or things that have been working for you.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, I couldn't make any of those work. And I finally wrote one that seemed to work, which was, my afflicted emotional states of mind are not logical states of mind because they can't make valid syllogisms.
Bravo! That one works.
It seemed to work.
Yeah, my afflicted states
that worked for me and helped my mind, I couldn't make them into logical syllogisms either.
Yeah, my afflicted states of mind are not logical.
Emotional states of mind are not logical states of mind because they can't make valid syllogisms.
Yeah, they can't make valid syllogisms.
So I wrote, I do not have renunciation of samsara because the dukkha of samsara is a sound argument that is not valid for me yet.
I do not have renunciation of samsara
because the dukkha of samsara is a sound argument that is not valid for me yet.
Because the dukkha of samsara is a sound argument that is not valid for you yet. Before you do anything else, you're going to have to prove that that reason works. You know, you're saying your reason is because the dukkha of samsara is a valid argument, but it doesn't work for me yet. Yeah, so you're going to have to really look. You're getting quite a complicated, yeah. It would be easier. What was the first part of your syllogism?
I do not have renunciation.
I do not have renunciation of samsara because I don't understand the dukkha of samsara. Make the reason simple. Your reason was, you know, the reason was because it's a correct argument that I don't understand. So then you're going to have to first say that to prove that the dukkha of samsara is a correct argument. And then you're going to have to prove that you don't understand it until that reason, you can even use that as a reason. It's much easier. Make your reason simple. Yeah, because I don't understand. Yeah. I don't have renunciation because I don't understand the dukkha of samsara. Yeah. But let's do. She wants us to try it. So what's the
subject is
I. Predicate is
don't have renunciation.
Reason? Because I don't understand the dukkha of samsara. Okay. So what's the property? I don't understand the dukkha of samsara. Don't you understand something about the dukkha of samsara? Is it true that you don't understand the dukkha of samsara? You wouldn't even make that argument if you didn't understand something about the dukkha of samsara.
I got stuck with the kind of like, do you need to realize it? Do you need to understand what is the extent? Like, because if you have renunciation, you are day and night, you know, wanting to get out.
Yeah.
Because you have, it's real for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just an understanding, you know, it's got to be, you know, more on the level of a realization.
So is it better if it says it's because I have not realized the dukkha of samsara?
That would be, yeah.
You don't have a realization of.
It would be clearer to say, because I have not realized the dukkha of samsara with a reliable cognizer. Okay. So then it would hold, I as the subject have not realized the dukkha of samsara with a valid cognizer, the reliable cognizer. True. Okay, then what's your privation?
If I have not realized renunciation.
Now, if, you know, it would have been better to say, instead of I haven't realized, because you'd say, I am someone who hasn't realized the dukkha of samsara. Anyway, if you're not someone who's realized with the dukkha of samsara with a valid cognizer, then you necessarily do not have renunciation. What? That's true. Yeah. Yeah. So that's showing that you have to gain a reliable cognizer about the dukkha of samsara to have full renunciation. Yeah. Maybe you have partial renunciation now.
Pretending.
No, you must have some.
Well, you would be in ropes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd probably have to actually remake it to say, I do not have a complete realization of renunciation. Yeah. Because you do have some understanding.
Syllogisms have come in online.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The first is enlightenment is possible for all beings because the Buddha reached enlightenment. And the second one is sentient beings.
Well, let's do one at a time. Enlightenment is possible for all sentient beings because the Buddha reached enlightenment. Okay? What's the subject? Enlightenment predicate?
It's possible for all sentient beings.
Reason? Because the Buddha attained enlightenment. Okay. Then, what's the property?
Enlightenment
is possible
because the Buddha attained enlightenment. It's possible for
Kirti.
No.
It was achieved by the Buddha.
No.
Enlightenment was achieved by the Buddha, you could say. It's a property. Was achieved by the Buddha.
Enlightenment, yeah. But because the Buddha achieved enlightenment. Okay. Enlightenment and the Buddha achieved enlightenment. No. You would have to say, you know, to refine it, enlightenment is it would be better to remake it, you know, the enlightenment of all sentient beings as a subject is possible because the Buddha
it was realized by the Buddha?
Because enlightenment was realized by the Buddha. But you see, then you get into, you have to prove that the Buddha realized enlightenment. But anyway, the fact that the Buddha attained enlightenment, does that mean that enlightenment is possible for everybody? No. That's not going to be a convincing reason, is it? Yeah.
I want to look at metal and snowboarding. That doesn't mean everybody will get to be able to do that.
Yeah. 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 So just because the Buddha attained an awakening doesn't mean that it's possible for everybody else. You have to have a better reason than that.
That the Buddha attained awakenment means it's possible.
Yeah, you could say that enlightenment is possible because the Buddha attained enlightenment. But you can't say the enlightenment of all sentient beings is possible. Okay.
Second one?
Okay, second one.
Sentient beings who kill are not inherently evil because they have Buddha nature.
Okay. So sentient beings are not inherently evil because sentient beings who kill are not inherently evil because they have the Buddha nature. Subject?
Sentient beings who kill.
Sentient beings who kill. Predicate? Are not inherently evil. Reason? Because they have the Buddha nature. Okay. So, what's your property?
Sentient beings who
kill. The Buddha nature. Okay, so sentient beings who kill have the Buddha nature. True. Okay, what's your privation? That's it. Yeah, so whoever has Buddha nature is not necessarily not inherently evil. True? False. True. So that one would work. Now, whether we've realized that or not, I mean, that's why we're making the syllogism, because you have to really meditate very deeply on the syllogism so that you're somebody who ascertains the three criteria.
Yeah.
You know, right now our ascertainment is kind of an assumption. Okay, well, let's go on. I thought we were going to get further. But we don't have so much time. Maybe we should do another syllogism. Do you feel like you're getting the feeling more of how to do syllogisms and how to make them? Yeah, so who wants to?
It just helped me see how to pick apart not valid syllogisms. And I wanted to share one that was advice from my dad and what I wish I had said.
Okay. So
in a nutshell, he said to me, Buddhist monastics do not contribute to society. No, Buddhist monastics are not beneficial to society because they don't contribute to the formal economy and live off others' earnings. So the subject is Buddhist monastics.
Buddhist monastics.
The property is Buddhist monastics.
No, what's the predicate?
Are not beneficial to society.
Are not beneficial to society. It's the predicate. That's what you're trying to prove.
Yeah. Why?
And the reason, why?
Because they don't contribute to the formal economy and they live off others' earnings.
Because they don't contribute to the formal economy and they live off others' earnings. Okay. Then, what's the property?
So Buddhist monastics don't contribute to the formal economy and live off others' earnings.
Is that true?
No,
that's not true. Why not?
You contribute to the formal economy.
Yeah.
Ask all the people, all the money we spend on
the economy. Yeah, we build buildings.
Yeah, just ask her. We contribute to the formal economy. Yeah, but let's don't even need to get into that. Okay. Yeah, so we do contribute. Also, the people who bring offerings here, you know, I think they help our local economy when they go to Safeway. Yeah. Okay. So the property doesn't hold. So already it's a bad argument. Then
there's no pervasion.
Okay. Then what's the pervasion?
Right. Whoever doesn't contribute to the formal economy and lives off others' earnings necessarily is not beneficial to society.
Is that true?
No. At which point I would have said to him, it follows that your mother is not beneficial to society. And he would have kicked me out of the house. I was like, darn it. That's what debate is for, right?
Yeah.
Why? Because she's a housewife. So anyway.
Yeah.
Children would fall in
there.
Children would fall in there. Don't have much mental capacity.
Yeah.
Define, I think, what is contribution to society.
Contribution to the economy, wasn't it? What was his?
Society was the predicate, right?
Not beneficial to society.
So in his way of thinking, you're only beneficial to society if you contribute directly to the economy and you don't live off the earnings of others. Yeah. So, yeah, like scratch all the children.
And your mom.
Yeah, and your mom, right? Yeah.
So since I'm retired then, I also don't, I'm not beneficial to society.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean. Okay, Venerable Jigme, did you have one you wanted to try?
Body pain changes moment by moment because it is impermanent.
Okay, subject?
Body pain.
Pain, predicate?
Changes moment to moment.
But, yeah. Reason?
Because it's impermanent.
Okay. And property?
Body pain is impermanent.
Really? Are you sure? When it hurts, are you sure it's impermanent?
This will lead me to the path of understanding this.
Okay. Yeah. So it's true. The body pain is impermanent. Yep. Then?
And then the pervasion, whatever is impermanent necessarily changes moment to moment.
Yeah, that's true. So that's a reliable syllogism. Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, in that syllogism, isn't changes moment to moment easier to realize than impermanent?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it probably is. Yeah. To say body pain is impermanent because it changes moment to moment. Yeah. Although, yeah, because the definition is easier to understand than the definiendum. Yeah. Okay.
The subject, Donnie Trump, is not an elected president because he was appointed by the Electoral College despite having lost the popular vote. By 2.86 million votes.
You don't have to give such a long reason. You can do it. Okay, then.
How was the subject?
The subject is Donnie Trump. The predicate is not an elected president. And the reason is because he was appointed by the Electoral College despite having lost the popular vote by 2.86 million votes.
Are you appointed by the Electoral College?
No, you're elected.
You're elected by the Electoral College.
Yeah, so I guess he's not popularly elected.
Yeah, he's not a popularly elected president. Yeah. And what's he going to say to you in response?
You're fired.
20 years ago, he criticized the Electoral College and said it should be abolished.
Really? What does this say? Don't you ever do something? That's right. Yeah. This will be the last thing, yeah?
My mind gets distracted because it lacks introspective awareness.
Okay. Subject?
My mind. Predicate is distracted. Mm-hmm. The reason, because it lacks introspective awareness. Okay. The property, my mind lacks introspective awareness. The pervasion, if it lacks introspective awareness, it's necessarily distracted. The counter-pervasion.
A table lacks introspective awareness.
It is distracted.
The table's distracted? You have to refine something in there. Yeah.
Yeah. If the mind, let's see, it lacks introspective awareness. Ah, it's a distracted mind.
Yeah, because it's a distracted mind. Right.
And then if it's not a distractive mind, then it does not lack introspective awareness.
Yeah.
It's a distracted mind that
if it's a distracted, if
a mind that lacks introspective awareness.
No, the privation would be if it's a distractive mind, then it necessarily lacks introspective awareness.
No, the privation was if it lacks introspective awareness, it's necessarily a distracted mind.
Mm. It needs to be a mind that lacks introspective awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's better. No, except that's your
mind that lacks. Because it's a mind that lacks. Because it's yeah. Okay, I see.
Yeah, you would have to say, my mind is a mind that lacks introspective awareness because it's a mind that is distracted. Is that what you're saying?
It's a distracted mind because it lacks introspective.
Yeah, because it's a mind that lacks introspective awareness. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that one would work. Yeah. So you see with all these, you have to be very particular in how you set it out. Yeah. This one's really the last one.
Pointed out that a mind that lacks introspective awareness could be sleeping and therefore not necessarily distracted.
No, but what are you trying to prove? The distraction or the lack of introspective awareness? She's trying to prove the lack of introspective awareness.
No, that's the reason.
My mind is distracted. It's a distracted mind because it's a mind that lacks introspective
awareness. But then it does the pervasion hold? Because if it's a mind that lacks introspective awareness, is it necessarily a distracted mind? And the question has come up, what about sleeping?
Well, I argue that you're also not concentrated while you're sleeping. You're also distracted, one could argue.
Yeah, you could say distracted to another object.
A series of objects.
Yeah. Yeah, is a sleeping mind distracted?
So when you're lethargic, your meditation, you're not paying attention to your object.
Right.
Why do you need to prove your mind is distracted?
No, you should be saying, my mind is a mind that lacks introspective awareness because it's a distracted mind. That way would. But that's what you said, isn't it?
No,
you said it the other way around. Okay, yeah. That's true. So you don't need to prove that your mind's distracted.
No, I was trying to prove that I needed to build up my introspective awareness muscle.
Yeah. So then you say, my mind is a mind that lacks introspective awareness because it's distracted. Yeah, and then it would work because if it's distracted, it necessarily lacks introspective awareness. Yeah.
Introspectively aware.
What?
Isn't that an introspectively aware statement to make?
What do you mean?
To realize that you're distracted. Just to state.
Yeah, she's just talking generally. She's not talking at this very moment. Yeah.
I was distracted while I was trying to meditate.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about so many of things. I'm not realizing.
Yeah, this one's really the last.
A syllogism is a comment. It says to create a syllogism, it seems to me it's best to build it up by almost in reverse, like figure out what the property is, then figure out what the pervasion is, and then look at the counter pervasion. And then if you build up your syllogism that way instead of just coming up with a sentence.
I think you have to start out with, what am I trying to learn something about? Yeah, no, not what am I trying to prove. First, what am I trying to learn something about? And then that becomes your subject. And then what am I trying to prove? What do I think may pertain to, what am I trying to prove about that subject? That becomes the predicate. And then the trick is to think of a reason that works. Yeah, but first, what is the thing I'm trying to learn something about?
Maybe. I don't know. I have pages of scribbles trying to create syllogisms about proving the existence of a Pure Land. And you know I got nowhere.
Yeah.
So that method, I got. I tried it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a hard one. You know, what you would probably have to do is prove the existence of Amitabha Buddha, and then based on his being an authoritative figure, yeah, because, you know, you can have that kind of inference.
Yeah, that's
but that's true. Not a total one that everybody's going to accept.
So I'm trying to understand how debate helps the practice, because I can see one person, if that person is really analytical and knows the scriptures on a superficial level, that person can be pretty good at debate. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that person realized it, right?
So. Yeah, the idea of debating is trying... It's, first of all, it's a pedagogical tool to get you to understand things. And when you first understand them, your understanding's very superficial. But when you think about it more and more and more and more, then it becomes clearer and it can become a valid inference. So that's one reason for debate. Second reason is when you come up, at least, ancient, when you come up with opponents, it is then a way to disprove the opponent's assertion and prove your own, which is important if you're trying to help people. And it's also important if you're trying to get rid of your own wrong ideas, because sometimes the opponent isn't an external person. It's our own wrong ideas. So if we can make some valid syllogisms here, then we can... disprove our own wrong ideas, which is helpful, yeah, especially when we hold on to our wrong ideas very strongly. Yeah, like her dad. Yeah? Yeah?
That's changed.
Yeah, thank goodness. But yeah. You got this whole trick about, look at Tibet, the population, so many men are monks, that's why they're so backward. And the communists took over. And I just got so angry I couldn't speak.
Yeah. Is he at a place now where he would debate that?
Probably. Yeah, I think his mind has changed, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Because the reason is, you know, monasticism is good because my daughter's a monastic. And the syllogism that you use to prove that is everything my daughter does is good because she's my daughter. That's perfectly reliable, isn't it?